This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
An old friend is with us today, and we generally love that on Dreamland, especially when they've been popular in the past. And this old friend certainly has been. I have known Steve Neal for longer than I would like to remember, at least since the late 80s. One of the more remarkable close encounter witnesses I know for a number of reasons. First, he is a brilliant artist and a filmmaker, and he can render his experiences into pictures, which is a fascinating capability. We'll be talking about that. Also, he took one of the best and probably one of the only UFO videos ever taken through a Celestron telescope. You can see it in the subscriber section in the video section of unknowncountry.com. And we'll talk about that and the whole experience and Steve Neal's life in general. And Steve, first, I want to welcome you to Dreamland.
Well, thanks, Willie. It's good to be back. It's always fun to be We've known each other so long, like you said.
Right, so long. And you came into my life. I believe you sent us a letter. How did that happen?
No, actually, right after communion, like 100 million other people, or at least 10 million that we know of. and I didn't hear anything back, which I expected because you were being literally flooded with email. This was something that you didn't even really quite anticipate. And that's why, of course, Annie went on to do the Communion Letters book. You were flooded, so I didn't hear anything. And then I sent you one of my busts, too, one of my alien busts. And I tried to get hired on Communion, the movie. And I got all the way in there, and they were all interested in hiring me, and then suddenly they decided to go with Tom Berman, who's a friend of mine. And so that was it for a few years. And then it was actually about 1989 or 90, I got a phone call from you, and at first I didn't think it was you. I thought somebody was playing a joke on me because, you know, it was someone that I really wanted to make contact with, but I didn't want to be some pushy fan. And it was you, and I didn't believe it at first. And you got a little indignant with me, but not too bad, and explained that this is Whitley Strieber. I said, okay, fine. And it was about the Communion Comics, Beyond Communion Comics, because you had seen my art on Siding and a lot of the TV programs that I had been on, and thought that the work I was doing with the Grays was really representative of what people were seeing. And that led to me doing the covers and working with Martin Powell on the Beyond Communion Comics from Caliber Comics. And so we started meeting in person. He would come knock on my door mysteriously one night, drag me off to a restaurant, and we just became friends.
Well, that's good. I remember pretty much the same thing. I approached many Close Encounter witnesses in that way. I was very careful because I didn't necessarily want to mail them letters. I didn't necessarily want to come into, in those days, email was pretty rare, but that type of contact. And so I would just phone them and we would talk. And in your case, I was quite interested because you have a very, very extensive lifetime of experience, which, like mine, is still ongoing right now.
Yeah.
But let's go back to the early days and the first time. And later on, folks, I'm going to watch for the first time, speaking of first times, some video Steve's working on, and we'll be talking about that as well, video that you'll be able to see, I think, fairly soon, that is basically illustrative of what it looks like in his Close Encounter experience. But let's now, Steve, go back to your very early days as a child when this entered your life.
Well, you know, I'll just go right to the first time. And, you know, I mean, to start off, I felt different. I would imagine that a lot of people would say they felt different because, you know, they're individuals. But I felt kind of like I didn't quite belong here, or there was some sort of mistake. And so I was a rather private kid and didn't talk a lot. I had friends, but I did talk about my interest in astronomy and the star space and that kind of thing very much, because I was afraid that they would think I was weird, which I am. So, but the first real solid experience was waking up in the middle of the night in San Francisco to complete silence. There was no sound. I could just hear my breath, and that was it. And everything was still, like it was frozen in time, and this beam of light was looking around my room, which fascinated me. I mean, I felt a little chill from it, and you know, I was mildly frightened, but I had a great curiosity, so I crept out of my bed and slid along the floor, staying against the wall, just under the windowsill, and then I peeked over. And then there were more lights, and they reacted to me looking out at them like they realized I was there. There he is, kind of thing. Then I got a little frightened, and I backed away, and I looked for some place to hide because it was, you know, kind of scary. And I hid under my desk. I thought, well, if I'm under my desk, the lights can't touch me there, and I can't reach me there, and whoever's outside the window won't be able to see me there, and it'll just go away. It didn't. It came inside the room. Somehow the lights came in the room. And found their way to me under the desk. And then that's when I saw something shadowy. It came towards me. And the next thing I knew, it was morning.
So that was the beginning.
That was the beginning, yeah.
Why do you think it happened to you?
I have no idea. I have some recollections of actually having a face looking through the bars of my crib. That I did an illustration of that looks very much like a gray type. But that particular experience, you know, it's one I still to this day remember absolutely consciously as if it happened yesterday. The story has never changed. It's remained the same. It's always the same sequence of events. And it was real. Whatever it was real. And I don't know why.
Yeah. And you don't know why, but what about your family?
Well, my family was kind of mysterious, really. You know, my dad, he was a fantastic artist and commercial artist, but he also worked for a private company called Hornbein Engineering, which did engineering contracts for the Navy on our nuclear subs out at Mare Island. He was involved with the Skipjack and the first Washington class, which was a modified Skipjack. That was our first boomer, which carried nukes. Then my mom was pretty brilliant. Her mom was incredibly brilliant and worked with Ansel Adams and worked in all kinds of chemistry and photography. And she was a very good photographer and did a lot of work for Ansel Adams. They were friends for years. And then there was my step-grandfather who worked on... He worked on the bomb, the first bomb, the Manhattan Project. And he was kind of a sad story, but you know, I'm not going to go into a lot of details about that. But he was amazing. He was the person in my family I loved the most, I would spend the most time with, because he would teach me so much about astronomy and physics and science, which was my fascination. But he was mysterious as well, and he was involved in very top-secret stuff. And the rest of my family was all pretty brilliant and all very different than the usual person. High IQs, very talented, lots of skills, degrees. So I grew up in that environment. I grew up in an environment of classical music and pretty smart people.
It's interesting.
But I felt there was a family secret, though.
Well, you know, Steve... Here's something fascinating about this. Mm-hmm. You are one of many. I did not know this about you before. I don't believe we've ever talked about it, but one of the signatures of Close Encounter is family member in the military, especially if they worked on atomic stuff or directly on the visitor issue.
That's correct.
And your father worked on atomic submarines. Okay, now I know this is the case now. I didn't the last time we talked. I know it for certain, but but what's so fascinating also that there is relationship with the Navy that is more than with the Air Force.
That's true. Because I've got friends who served in the silent service and also on board aircraft carriers and other Navy ships that have told me amazing stories that I was never supposed to, talk about again type of thing. But I've heard them many, many times. I've been pulled aside more than once by someone who saw me back in the 90s on television with you and just by myself on shows. When I did that, many people in my industry, visual effects in Hollywood, it was a clearinghouse of friends and colleagues because they just thought I was crazy, right? So I'm at a convention and one of these people, and he will remain nameless, pulled me aside. He's a very well-known artist and told me about his time in the Army. And he said, "I don't think you're crazy. Let me tell you a story." Now, you've heard this a million times. I'm just repeating the same thing that's happened to you repeatedly, probably. And they tell you, as he did, about he was working on radar and how, literally 8 or 9 unidentified objects would come and would come to the base and they'd hover over the base and there'd be some sort of exchange. And you've heard this before. Everyone listening has heard this before. But I can actually verify at least that people I know have told me the same stories, and many of them have been Navy people, more so than Army Air Corps, or Air Force, because Army Air Corps, of course, was before the Air Force. So,
well, yeah, I mean, one of the things that happens is that when pilots are exposed to the visitors, especially if they exhibit hostile intent toward the visitors, like Air Force planes, when they arm their missiles and stuff, then the next thing you know, these little guys show up in the homes of the pilots and in their children's lives. And that happened to you. Do you know what your father did do you?
No, all I knew is he was an engineer. He was right before he died mysteriously on the way to work when I was only 14. He was vice president of the company. He was killed by a drunk driver on the way to work, which caused him to veer off the road in the fog. And he was being chased by the highway patrol and he went off a bridge.
Oh my, that must have been.
He was 34.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Louise. And
details were sketchy, and for some reason, the guy that did it was let go, and I was in court when that happened. He pleaded mercy on the court, and it was just odd, the whole thing. And
he was let go? The guy who did it?
Yeah.
Drunk driving, kills somebody, and he's let go?
He had no priors. He had a good job, a good family, and all this kind of thing. He pled mercy, and the jury let him go.
Well, yeah, so. Okay. Well, that's fair enough. It's not a conspiracy. We don't do that anymore, but this is a long time ago.
Yeah, it was. It was in the 60s. So,
yeah.
Like 1964, 65, right in there. But
so, but was your dad alive when you first saw the visitors? Yes, he was.
Yeah, he was. And, of course, later in life, I got the sense very much so that they knew something about it. And my mom was kind of bitter, and we weren't real close. And in fact, for 18 years, we didn't even talk. One day I called her up and she talked to me and she said, "I've seen you on those TV shows with that Whitley guy."
The bad guy.
The bad guy. And, I got to tell you something. And then she started telling me stories, and she told me a story. She was with my grandmother on the porch, and she lived out by
Steve
Ray. Yes.
I have some bad news for the free Dreamlanders. They've got to wait through these commercials before they hear this story. But think of it, free Dreamlanders, subscribers are hearing it while you listen to these ads. Did you know that you can get the Path and the Communion Letters each for $3.99 as ebooks on Amazon? That's right, The Path and The Communion Letters. These are two fascinating books. The Path, of course, I wrote. It is a really unusual insight into the Tarot and what it actually means, something that's probably been hidden there for a long, long time. But when you read it, you realize that the Tarot of Marseille had to be about this because it's so beautifully organized. It was a discovery I made back in the 1970s, and now you can find out for yourself just how powerful a presence in your life and a guide the Tarot can be. The Path, $3.99. The other book I want to talk about is The Communion Letters. If you have not read this, you need to. This is the best book of close encounter and abduction experiences ever created. It was created by Ann Strieber. The letters in it are now part of a permanent archive at Rice University, along with thousands of others that she collected. And I have to tell you, it is absolutely unique in the world. Also, $3.99. Don't miss either of these great books. They're terrific. And I'm very proud of The Path. It's unique in the world, and I'm so proud of Anne for having created The Communion Letters, also unique in the world. Linda Moulton Howe has appeared many, many times on Dreamland, 85 shows in total. It is a literal treasure trove of amazing Linda Moulton Howe material. Listen to this excerpt from November the 8th, 2013, of an interview she did with an officer from Ellsberg Air Force Base talking about a UFO incident that took place there. As we listen in, she is just asking him about a guard who woke up in a field, unable to explain how he got there.
When he became conscious and found himself in the field, his gun was off to the side of his body.
It was in the mud.
You do not think he had two shoes and socks off?
You know, he started walking towards the lights that were reflecting up close. He didn't know what the lights were, but he was going that way because that's where it was lighted. After he started walking, he realized that one of his boots was missing.
Huh.
It was a fully laced combat boot, which was not a zipper type, so it had to have been taken off.
You can listen to the rest of this interview and so much more. Linda Moulton Howe material, all kinds of extraordinary material on unknowncountry.com, plus meditations, all kinds of experiences, Whitley Strieber audiobooks. It's a really rich treasury of material, unlike anything else in the world. Get involved in unknowncountry.com. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today. We're talking to Steve Neal, a longtime friend and close encounter witness. His website, steveneals.art.blog. And we're going to be talking about Steve's art very soon. But let's go back now to that call from your mother. She saw you on TV with me, and she called you after a long estrangement. What happened?
Yes. She told me about the night that my grandmother and her were sitting out on her front porch, and she lived out in San Anselmo, her house was. It was just near Point Reyes. It's kind of out in the middle of nowhere in Northern California. And she had a few acres and this little ranch. And they're sitting on the porch, And it's a very dark night. You can see all the stars, no moon. And she sees this black circle blotting out the stars, moving slowly towards the house. This fascinated her. And as it got closer, some very weird lights started moving around in it, and they shined right on her and on the porch. And this fascinated both of them because they really weren't sure what they were dealing with. They had no idea. And she backed into the house. So they went into the house because we were starting to get a little worried about it, as anyone in the right mind would, because it was completely silent, she said. There was no sound whatsoever. And the lights continued to shine through the window to where they went inside the house. And then my mom went quiet. And she said, "So is that a UFO?" And I said, "Yes, a UFO, Mom." I said, "What happened then?" And there was this long silence. And she said, "You know, I don't remember." So you have to imagine what that was like for me. And I still get chills even now as I'm telling the story, because here I was going to think my mom would think I was crazy and my son, batty and all this kind of stuff. And yet this stuff had been happening to her too. And she
now, how old? What age were you? I'm a little confused about the timeline.
The timeline? Well, that was about 10 years ago she told me that story.
Yeah, and but when did it actually happen to her?
It happened recently, within that time frame. It had happened within a few weeks or months.
Oh, so it happened long after you started to have experiences.
Yeah.
Meaning that she probably doesn't remember a lot.
Well, she remembered me being too afraid to sleep in my own bed at night, bed with them. I'm sleeping in front of the – I would sleep on the rug in front of their bed, my mom and dad's bed. And she remembers me talking about people in the walls or fairies or something I believed were there, and strange lights and all that. She did remember that. And the other thing is we had this gardener, and – He was Asian, and he would come weekly, and he had one of those straw hats and everything, and he kind of looked like Yoda, and he was this old guy, and he'd come in the backyard, and he'd start, and I'd always go and talk to him because he was really smart. We'd talk about astronomy and things and stuff, and I brought that up to her. I never had an Asian gardener. True story. Said we never had a gardener that did that.
Huh.
And I remember he's this little guy too, you know. So, but there were things she did remember, and I think she just didn't know what to do. I mean, how do you deal with that? You know.
Yeah.
And she knew there was stuff going on in the family. The whole family was estranged and secretive and mysterious and. So, you know, reflecting on it now, I look back, I kind of know what might have been going on. I can't say for certain. You can never say for certain. I can't even say that what happened to me was absolutely reality-based, but it certainly was consciously based, and there was communication between this consciousness and me. And that was very real, that part of it.
I think all of us who are in the abductee situation are in the same boat. Have you ever had some actual physical abductions, haven't you?
Yeah, quite a number of them.
And me too.
Some when I'm conscious and some where I will be awake, answer the door, someone bullies their way into the house, drags me to the back of to my bedroom, and I pass out, and then I wake up face down with my robe off and marks on my back, and I don't remember a lot of it. I've had that kind of
stuff. Yeah, you call me about that or send me emails about it all the time, Steve.
Well, yeah, well, you also, we were at a MUFON event when we spent the night, and Anne was there. And the next morning, I took my shirt off and showed you, and there were all these like electrical burns on my spine.
That's right.
You knew exactly what those were. You talked about it in confirmation. And, you know, that had happened. It was a very odd night, as you remember. And there were a number of people that were there at that group, all, for lack of a better term, were had abduction experiences that night. You didn't, but they did.
And right. Everybody except me and Ann.
Yeah. So,
yeah, that was absolutely remarkable. Why don't we do this? Why don't you go into that? It set the scene for us. We've talked about it, I think, with Yvonne Smith on the show before, and Roger Lear, God rest his soul. But why don't you tell us your story and tell us where it was? It was down in San Diego. Is that correct?
No, you're thinking about the San Diego event at that hotel, the famous hotel.
Yeah, okay. Well, enlighten me then.
This was in Moore Park, and Alice Levy was putting on an event there for the
I remember
con.
Now.
And we stayed in the hotel there. Roger had given me a Gauss meter. And I went into my room.
is Roger Lear.
Roger Lear, dear friend. And I laugh, everyone, because it's just comical at times. I don't know how else to describe it. But the ridiculous things that happen that people think have to be far fetched and have to be untrue really are. That's the joke. So I go into my room. I turn on the Gauss meter, and I run it over my bed, and the meter's pinned. I go over to the TV set. It's pinned. I go in the bathroom. It's pinned. And it's wavering all over the place. Like there's something in my room. Your room happened to be directly over me. But maybe that's what it was. I don't know.
I have a Gauss meter here, and I don't use it very much anymore.
Why would you bother?
Why bother? I mean, because their visitors show up here every night, and when they show up here, the Gauss meter is going to go off the rails.
Sure.
And incidentally, my security camera system, they have fixed it, but good. And what happens is I can leave it on 24 hours a day now. And at 11 o'clock at night, it automatically turns itself off and then turns itself on again at 6 o'clock in the morning. It's not programmed to do that in any way, but it does. So I figure, good. At least, I don't have to worry about most of the day. It does not happen if I'm not here. In other words, if I'm not here, it stays on.
That's
fascinating.
It is, and it does make you laugh. I mean, it's funny.
And what's interesting is the programming. If there is programming involved, and I don't know about that, has to be in the camera because the company that the monitoring company says they have there's absolutely nothing in the system that would do that.
Yes, of course, they always say that.
Yeah, right.
Because they're right. There isn't.
Yeah, exactly. There is not.
We're dealing with some pretty smart people here, or beings, or something. I don't know what an intelligence.
How do you feel about them when you're with them?
That's just child's play for them.
You have physical experiences from time to time, like mine, quite brief, but they do happen.
Yes.
How do you feel about the visitors now?
Well, I used to be somewhat annoyed by it, even a little afraid. Felt sort of a darkness from it all, and maybe it was something that really wasn't a good thing. But as I age and as I have more experience with this subject matter and with them, for some reason I can't explain, and this has certainly been more recently, I have this tremendous sense of well-being, and I feel that they have been of great assistance to my life, moreover to my soul, to my ability to focus myself better and not be reacting as much to fear.
Yeah.
And anger. And I have my most recent experience, this was something I was talked to and told that I really have to let go of any anger that I have if I'm able to rise up above man's ability for hate and destructive nature, that we have to rise above that. It's the most important thing we can do if we're going to be able to stretch our wings, so to speak, and explore all the things that we are keeping ourselves from that is self-imposed. We're prisoners of our own fear and anger and hate. And I feel that they're trying to release that in us, or at least some of us, to try to get us to move beyond it. And what comes with it is, if you apply it, is this sense of well-being that is difficult to describe. It's joyful, it's a happiness, but it's something more than that. I feel like I can really, really, for the first time in my long life, focus well on my creativity, being an artist and expressing the things I've experienced and being able to share them with other human beings. So the way I feel about all this now is that it's part of my life, and I don't object to it. And sometimes it's rough because Monday mornings seem to be a favorite time to do things. And so you wake up rather in deep thought and physically heavy, if that's a description for how I feel, not necessarily pain, but physically heavy. And, you know, on top of that, it's Monday and I've got a busy day at the studio, and you have to suck it up and move on through your day and get a lot accomplished. And that almost seems as though it's part of some sort of gauntlet or education, perhaps, that's being manifested by the visitors. They're trying to get you to reconnect with this darn universe that we've separated ourselves from completely, yeah, other than totally, and Mother Nature itself, which we are so much a part of.
Yes,
physically, but also it there's a greater depth to that with our consciousness.
That is so well said, because I think that's a lot of us in this whole arc of from fear to acceptance to beginning to gain something from it, from the relationship, is something that I'm experiencing and a lot of other people are experiencing. And it's why the website is as it is, because with a lot of nodes of social access, which the visitors wanted from the beginning, you know, where people can comment in the free section as well as in the subscriber section and so forth. And if you read the comments about close encounter experiences, people are having very intimate experiences that are in some way not exploitative. In other words, they seem to be sharing,
yes,
with us, sharing themselves with us as, yeah, selves. There's, oh, Free Dreamlander, speaking of sharing, share these ideas and these commercials with all of your friends, but mainly share unknowncountry.com with your friends and do what they do, which is, as soon as they see this site, they're going to subscribe immediately because they know how important it is, and so should you. This is Whitley Strieber. Listen to me now from June of 2010 talking to Alan Lammers about an incredible thing that happened to him on the island of Sulawesi in Indonesia. Here you are in South Sulawesi, in the little town in the district of Sandu Batu. What happened? You were told something rather strange.
Well, we were told before we went, like my friends that I worked with the NGO, they told me that when you pack, because it kind of happened by accident, I went out to buy a raincoat. It rains quite a bit in this part of the world. And so I went out and I bought a yellow raincoat. And my friend said, I'm sorry, you can't take that to Walla Walla. And I said, well, why not? And he says, well, you can't wear that color. So anyways, excuse me. So I thought, okay, well, what colors can I wear? They said, well, you can only wear black or white. You cannot wear any bright colors, no bright green, especially no yellow. And, you know, that's all you should bring. And I said, well, what would happen? And they said, well, people disappear.
You will find the rest of that story, and it is brain-bending, in the June 5th edition of Dreamland, June 5, 2010 edition of Dreamland in the unknowncountry.com archive. This archive is one of the richest of its kind in the world, probably is the richest of its kind in the world, filled with extraordinary shows, of which this show is certainly one, this show with Alan Lammers. You will never have heard anything like it. It does what Dreamland is here to do. It opens your mind to the fact that we live inside a hidden reality that we prefer not to acknowledge, but not here. Here on unknowncountry.com, we do acknowledge it. We live in it and we love it. Subscribe today. You can't go wrong. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and get started.
Owls are somehow connected to UFOs. I don't say that lightly. After over a decade of obsessive investigation, I am convinced of this connection. As strange as it may seem, people are seeing owls in the highly charged moments of a UFO sighting and within the challenging memories of UFO abduction. This mystery has been the focus of my research. My name is Mike Cleland, and I have explored these connections in my book, The Messengers. At its core, this book is simply a collection of stories, and each is a remarkable real-life experience. The Messengers is also my own story of how owls played a role in my life. It's an exploration into the deeply personal questions that arose from my own contact experiences. The Messengers is the first in a trilogy of books, and each volume explores a deeper aspect of the UFO mystery. All my books are available on Amazon in paperback, ebook, and very soon as audiobooks.
We're talking to Steve Neal. His website is steveneals.art.blog, a wonderful site where you can find much more than art about his close encounter experiences, which is in and of itself fascinating enough. But he's also been, for many years, a special effects artist of the first order and builds the best models and masks and so forth I've ever seen. I mean, they are really high order of quality. Can you tell us a little bit about that aspect of your career?
Sure. We were talking earlier offline and about that, and this has come up a lot. Why choosing the path career wise to make monsters for a living? And it's kind of, if you're a close encounters witness experiencer, it answers itself. I mean, if from a very early age, the Twilight Zone is your life, then you're going to have a real fascination, with things like growing up The Outer Limits, which is a tremendously good science fiction TV series, probably one of the best that was ever made, because of the messages that were in it. And they're not unlike the same messages the Visitors are trying to communicate to us right now. But the aliens, the creatures that were in those TV shows and Star Trek and others were fascinating to me, as Frankenstein was. And so I had this love affair as a kid with science fiction. I read a lot of science fiction, a lot of Robert Heinlein and Asimov and other authors, and Ray Bradbury, who I later got to know and be friends with. And I wanted to be involved in that somehow. So I ended up, after high school, making contact with Francis Ford Coppola, of all people, and became an intern and a friend working at his Zoetrope. But then at the same time, I wanted to find out how they did the makeup of the Planet of the Apes. And I did, and I found it out, and I started to replicate what they did and made myself up as a chimp from Planet of the Apes. And then that led to me doing other types of makeups and masks. And when the Zoetrope closed down and Francis and Lucas and everybody moved down here, I moved down here too. And the next thing I found myself doing, and this is the short story, was working on the Planet of the Apes TV series, because they were so taken by my work that I had done on my own and learned. And there weren't a lot of people doing this kind of work back then. The old guard was kind of on the way out. All these new rock and roller kids coming in. And I was the first of that wave, along with Rick Baker and some other people. And so one of the things I did too was make masks. I love making masks. They're pieces of art. But I like replicating some of the famous and of course, this all led to a very long career, which is still going on at age 68. I work every day. I run my studio.
Your studio is a busy place.
It's busy, yeah. I mean, I've got clients. I've got my mask store is selling props, everything. And it just never stopped. And my passion for it, my enthusiasm for it, has not waned at all. In fact, if anything, it's increased as I get older. You know, every day I wake up excited like a little kid. What am I going to make today? What am I going to get today? What, you know, what's going to happen? What's the phone going to bring this time? And I'm restoring for a client one of the studio scale models from Space 1999 right now. And here's this eagle in my possession right now, and I'm taking it apart and seeing how they built it. It's just a fascinating thing to have in my life, but I'm pretty damn sure that the influence came from that first night that I saw those lights come in my window. I had been and ever since been a kid that has been fascinated with the unknown, not afraid of it, but wanting to know it so it is no longer an unknown. I wanted to explore it. So what better way to do that than work in science fiction films making aliens? So
yeah, that makes sense.
It's full of it, but also I have an extensive gallery of my old work I did for Yvonne Smith during the 80s and 90s, and some recent artwork too that I've done of the visitors that are mostly gray oriented. In fact, pretty much my artwork of the grays really set the look of them commercially. I mean, right down to the Alienware computer I have basically has my graphic on it glowing green. But I haven't been seeing things that look like gray that much lately. And what I've been dealing with seems, at least when I see the form, it's more human than gray. Although, the other night I'm watching television with Mary, and we have this hallway that faces into our living room that's our home theater. And I saw something move, and I just casually looked over it, and there was a gray standing right there looking at me around the corner. I looked over at Mary. I looked back, and I thought, should I say anything or not? And I didn't. I didn't even tell her until like a few days later.
Yeah.
It just looked at me. It didn't even make an effort to cover itself up, and then it just went into our meditation room, which is where we do yoga and meditation. And I didn't get up. I didn't go run in there to look at it like I would have done 20, 30 years prior. I just accepted it and knew that I had seen something, and it was okay. It was fine.
Yeah, well, exactly. This is kind of how I feel now. Now, your wife who passed away, Jilly, was not comfortable at all with this, as I recall.
No one in the family was. It was a really bad thing. It caused a lot of stress and a lot of problems.
Yeah, because I know I was always a pariah around that house, pretty much.
Yeah.
How about Mary?
Mary's fine.
She's good with it.
Yeah, she's very good with it. She's highly intelligent, and she's been around it and had things happen in her life before she met me, seeing ghosts and things that have made her very open-minded about what we don't know.
You met on Facebook, is that correct?
No, we actually met on a dating site.
On a dating site, yeah.
Yeah, which was, you know, a friend of mine put me up to doing it, and I just thought it was ridiculous, but that's how we met.
Well, I'm glad you did, because you've been very happy together.
Yes, we have and are.
Yeah.
So, and she's very comfortable with it, and she knows when, like, they'll come in the bedroom, and you can just see their shadows, and they'll do things like poke you, and you just know they've been there.
Yeah.
And sometimes we even wake up and see it for a minute, and then it's like, there's nothing going on here, just go back to sleep. Okay, fine. But she's aware of it, too, so.
You know, we're talking about a level of life that's like an iceberg. Most of it is beneath the surface.
That's correct.
Yes, but you have a little bit on the surface, and I have a little bit on the surface, and a lot of our listeners do too. But we're not alone in the sense that if you go beneath the surface, what you see, I think, is a structure that is life, and that it is actually governing not just our lives but all of human life. And
I agree. It's everyone.
Yeah, right. It is simply what we are.
But people have chosen to have fear, to deny it, and separate from it. And the results are the condition of this biosphere right now on a physical level is that very act of being afraid to connect with your own true nature and nature in general. And it's destroying the world.
Outside
is terrible.
It's reflected in our society because people who deny global warming generally are not close encounter witnesses. It's not 100% because there are people who are close encounter witnesses who do it, but they haven't had the experience.
No.
I've had and you've had. I mean, I had when I was young in this, one of the most terrifying things I ever saw was the earth exploding and my son dying. And in a series of experiences in October of 1985, and it's happening. The earth is on fire, and my son's generation is in terrible jeopardy.
Yeah,
absolutely. And so are his children. And this I just think about every day of my life. It never leaves my mind.
It can't continue. It just cannot continue.
Of course it can't.
And it's the disconnect of human beings from what they actually are and what they're part of and that which they deny.
Right.
And that denial is incredibly dangerous.
It's lethal. It leads to the death of the species.
The animal kingdom were in connection with it. The indigenous people were always. And they were called savages because they believed in sky gods and having a deep connection with nature and this planet being a living organism. They were considered, you know, just savage, crazy people.
Right. Of course, Christians don't think about the fact that they believe in a sky god, too, but that's another story.
Yeah, exactly. I know. But it's just, you know, we have to reconnect. We do.
We have to because we're running rapidly out of time.
We are, and there's a lot of good souls here that don't need to, you know, be destroyed as a result of a majority's
Well, you know, it's not that souls are going to be destroyed. It's that their access to change is going to be tremendously diminished by a lack of available bodies. That's how the visitors have put it to me. That and that we're not going anywhere. In other words, our process is part of the earth. It is not going to be repeated. They're not going to be taken to another planet. That's not to say that the species has not been planted elsewhere, but we were planted.
Oh, it has.
Go ahead and talk about that.
No, it has. I mean, I just know it has been. It's been shown to me. It's been told to me.
I think that's what the abductions were about. I think all the sexual material that was taken was to build another version of the human species elsewhere.
But you know, before humanoids were even put here on this planet, they were already existed. Is my hunch. I don't like the word belief. I either know something or I have a hunch about something, but it's just a gut feeling.
Me too. I feel very much the same way. And
this isn't our first rodeo, as they would say.
No. All right. Let's go on now. And I'd like to move on to the recent – it's now been a few years, that sighting that you had, that you called me on the phone while you were having it.
Right.
But before we do that, Free Dreamlanders – we're going to do this. The UnknownCountry.com archive is one of the richest internet archives, podcast archives in the world, without question. It has a literal wealth of material, nearly 1,000 editions of Dreamland alone, and so much more. And speaking of so much more, listen to this from Nick Redfern from 2013. He's talking about viruses that apparently appeared in the context of UFO crashes back in the 50s and 60s, things that have been virtually forgotten and swept under the rug. But shouldn't we be thinking about strange viruses right now? I think it very definitely is something we should be thinking about. Here's Nick from Subscriber Specials in 2013.
And when they finally got to the location and found whatever it was, and reportedly it had been tracked on radar coming down somewhere in the big thicket, so they knew there was something to be found. But what was sort of very disturbing is that in several of these recoveries, apparently there wasn't just one in the big thicket in the area, but there's actually three or four between 58 and 61. And every time the retrieval teams got close to these objects until they decided the guys had to be fitted out with hazmat uniforms, they'd be overcome by nausea and dizziness, and reportedly two of them died of like a flesh-eating virus, not unlike what today we would call Ebola.
You can get this and so much more from UnknownCountry.com. To find this particular interview, just go to the search engine and click on Alien Viruses and Subscriber Specials, and you'll find it right away. It's easy to search the UnknownCountry.com archive. There's a year-by-year podcast archive, and there's a powerful search engine, too. And, of course, we're always ready to help. If you've got a search question for us, just send it to subscribers at UnknownCountry.com. So subscribe to Unknown Country. Get involved. Keep this beautiful thing going, because it is really extraordinary. Unknown Country is, well, that's the word. It's extraordinary. Help us keep it that way. And above all, use it. Explore with it. There is so much here. Go to unknowncountry.com right now. It's time to subscribe.
Whitley's new book, A New World, is getting great reviews. American cosmic author Diana Walsh-Pasulka says, "Enter this risky new world and leave empowered." New York Times reporter Leslie Keen says, "Riveting. I couldn't put it down." Amazon reviewers are calling it life-changing, mind-opening, the first real description of what contact is like and will be like. Don't miss A New World. As Professor Jeffrey Kripal says in his preface, this book is Contact. Get A New World today. Available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on Audible.com.
As always, Dreamland's theme music is The O of Pleasure from Ray Lynch's beautiful album, Deep Breakfast, available at raylynch.com. We're talking to Steve Neal. His website is steveneals.art.blog. And on it, you can see all kinds of things. All of his work is there, a lot of beautiful stuff. Among the things that you should definitely look at is the section called book covers, because you'll find covers to the wonderful but all too brief Beyond Communion series, comic book series that we did together. And unfortunately, the comics are now long unavailable. I don't ask for them because I can't give them to you. And then you will see the book covers he's done for me years ago, my book of short stories, Evenings with Demons. He recently did one for Transformation for the new cover, but the publisher rejected it, which was very disappointing. However, by the time the Afterlife Revolution came along, I'm the publisher now, and I didn't reject it, and I consider it to be one of the finest book covers I've ever seen for anybody, and especially for me. It's the one, you know it, of the hands and the white moth between them. It's a brilliant cover. And I had, then after that, some difficulty with the graphics. It's a long story, but hopefully I'll be able, the next book, the Jesus book, I'm going to ask Steve to do the cover for, because I have figured out some things about the graphics that we didn't do then and we need to do. Okay, wow. So let's get back to this event that took place. You're out in the backyard, and what happens?
Yeah, well, we were just wrapping up my film, But Something Is There, and I didn't like the ending, and I needed a better ending for it, something to really cap it off, and I was on the phone with you in the backyard, just like I am now, and I'm talking away, and I look over to the northwest, and I see what looks like a bird at night. You know, when an owl or a bird flies over, it's not a real big city where I live, but there's enough light coming up from the streetlights and stuff that it will make the bottom of an owl kind of glow. Reflect the light, and you can see it moving. And I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking, that's an owl, and it kept getting closer. And as it did, it then kind of, like a heat wave, became a triangle, a very definite, very defined, very sharp-edged triangle flying along, and it had these, they almost looked like candle lights at each point. They kind of flickered, and they were kind of an amberish-colored, incandescent-feeling type light. And it moved very slowly. It allowed me to see it. And, of course, I'm describing all this to you, and I'm kind of – my breath – as many times this has happened to me, it always takes my breath away. It's just – it's a wonderful thing to see. You know, it's just a confirmation that there's so much more to our reality than we ever dreamed of. And there it is. And I'm trying to get this all across to you, wishing you were here. And you get sort of exasperated. And then it moved off rather slowly, kind of flickering. And then it just disappeared past the trees that I'm looking at right now. I couldn't see it beyond the trees. And then after I got off the phone with you, I walked in the house, and I heard in my mind, it's almost like a subtitle.
Yeah.
You know, it was, there's still hope. Don't give up.
That was very inspiring to me, because you called me during the sighting.
Right.
And then that happened right afterwards. You were on the phone when you
when that happened.
Did I? Yeah. I thought I called you afterwards, but.
No, it was after you said it as it happened. You were still on the phone with me.
I was pretty excited, you know. I try not to get excited so I can keep my wits about me and really be a good observer.
Yeah.
But it's hard sometimes. And then that, of course, became the ending of the film. Exactly.
Right. So, of something. And where can people see the film?
It's on Vimeo. It's on my Vimeo account. And in fact, I believe on the Artist Steve Neal, there is in the menu, but something is there, and the film is right there. It's free to watch.
Yeah, and I believe there has been an ad for it on unknowncountry.com.
It on for quite a while.
About 6 weeks, yeah.
Initially, it got about 1 million views, and then YouTube and the people that had put it up took it down because there was some copyright infringement, they said, with one particular piece of music, which all the music, I was very careful to make sure was all legal to use, but they insisted that wasn't. And it was a big pain in the butt to try to remove it.
Yeah, that happens on YouTube. They don't have their algorithms correct. No, there's this thing called the Orchard that looks for copyright violations in music tracks and finds – I have that happen to me too. It finds things that are violation – that it claims are violations that aren't. But once the violation is claimed, YouTube always believes them 100% whether you have proof otherwise or not.
Yeah, that's true. They won't even return an email or a phone call. So
they just drop you.
Because it's too risky for them, and it's a time eater, and they're all about money. And if there's a chance in hell they can get sued at all, they don't even want to deal with it. So you're out of the air wall.
Right. Exactly.
So I started a Vimeo account, and I pay for that account. And if you do use music that I really like, the band, which is two people called Hammock, and I use just. On a little clip I had, I put a little piece of that film, of that music of his, of theirs to it. And when I played it, the music was gone. They removed the audio, but at least they left the clip up, you know? But for the most part, they will not do that to you. And Hammock is rather recent. If you haven't heard his music or their music before, it's quite good. It's an ambient type of sound. So it's on Vimeo and it is free to watch. I do pay for the account, but I think it's worth it because that way the people who are fans of my work can see good quality playback, and you can see it on the home theater and the big screen, and there's no ads, there's no things popping up and that kind of stuff. It's just, I think they're really a class act, so, and well worth the money.
Yeah. Yeah, well, okay, so you can get it, folks, on and also you can click through from the Dreamland show page this week, and we'll put the ad up for it as well. It's a lovely film, and
you're in it.
I am in it. That's true, but it's also a lovely film.
it's a real different piece on this subject, simply because I didn't win a lot of. People on this film. It was kind of divided down the middle. Half of them hated it, half of them loved it. The people that hated it perceived this experience as something very threatening, very dark.
Yeah.
And they buy into all the deep conspiracy and the fact that I did not do that. And I didn't claim that I knew what I was dealing with really angered a lot of people. But at the same time, and I still to this day get emails from people all the time for the book and for the film, and thanking me because they felt after seeing the film or reading the book, they didn't feel crazy anymore. Now, I know you know what the
I know that about. Very well. Yeah.
Yeah, really
you and I are probably crazy. Among the greatest psychoanalysts in the world. we've cured a lot of people of.
Oh, God, when they hate you, they really hate you. And I really had the bad ones, but the good ones far outweigh it. So.
Yeah. When you know, we have to, I want to just. And make a little inflection point here about the good versus bad. And it is this. The good visitors are real. So are the ones that do not have our best interests at heart, in my opinion. And how they are part of us and connected to us is another issue entirely, but the Crabwood formation, crop circle formation, which is the one with the sort of alien face on it and the disc in the, it made into the crop circle.
Right.
Which translates essentially to, essentially the same message that you got that night, which is there is good out there. Don't give up.
And that's the one that materialized next to a radio station in a highway that no one saw.
No, this was the crab in Crabwood in England.
Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. But remember, those are the visitors that people like me and Steve are involved with. That's why we're like we are, and most close encounter witnesses are too. And, it, you know, it's a long journey. It's been a very long journey for me because the initial waking up is hard. There's no getting around it. But then over time, you make a choice. You're either going to make this work in your life or you're not. But they, remember, they are not here. There is a resistance here. Beware, it says, of those bearing gifts. And that's the ones the government is interested in. Those are the ones when you hear about the materials and all of the secret stuff going on with weapons design and so forth. Those visitors are the ones that – those are not the good guys. And that's who the government is involved with. That's who they engaged with because they wanted the weapons and the technology. They wanted the gifts. I didn't ask for any gifts, and I don't have any gifts, and I don't want any gifts. I have a piece of some of the material from Roswell that Art Bell gave me, but I don't do anything with it, very purposely. Linda Moulton Howe sold hers for $35,000 to TTSA, and that's fine. I don't have any objection to that, but mine's not going anywhere because of this, because until – we have a very clear idea of what the different levels are. We have to be really, really careful and really thoughtful. And I think that most of us abductees who stay with it end up with the good guys.
It certainly seems that way.
Now, Steve, but we're getting toward the end of the first hour. And right now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at your video that you've got up on Vimeo, the preview of Transfigured Night. This is the first shot opening. I've never seen it before in my life. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at it. It's a lovely piece. Okay. Looking at it. There we go. Okay. What happens is there's this beautiful wall of stone, like a gigantic cliff. And now we're coming in, and there's a man standing, looking out over a vast, what looks like a sort of otherworldly desert or canyon. What is that, Steve?
It's something I've been made privy to pretty often. You know, Whitley, I go to bed at night, and I never know where I'm going to end up. But literally, I just don't. Some nights, I just dream and just have nonsensical dreams.
You think of yourself as seeing other worlds.
But other times, I come to, I have breath, taste, smell, feeling. I'm there.
And like I'm you're in on another in another world.
Exactly. And I get to explore it. And I always feel that I'm not alone, that there's a guide in all this. But I'm allowed to roam free in it, pretty much, in even since there, be able to converse with them and interact. And I do get noticed. It's like the people there, they are human, react to me as though I'm out of place, but I always get the sense of, oh, it's him again, or it's one of those people again. In fact, I wrote about one of them on Short Stories by Steve Neal. It's another website I have, and it's called Skimming Under the Ice of Other Worlds. And I remember you read it, and
you were quite taken by it. And it really accurately described what happened to me when this stuff happened, you know, because I was in this world that looked sort of, you know, I had that post-apocalyptic look to it, but it looked recovered. And there were these large sort of brushed in a steel-looking pods, like an aircraft without wings that had been abandoned in various parts around this city. And I remember walking over and looking at a newsstand, and it had this it had a newspaper there, and it was printed on, like it had been actually printed on an old press or something. And I could read the date, 2088. I remember a woman coming out and asking me what I was looking for. And it just, you know, I mean, what I'll do often is I'll walk over to like a piece of structure or a tree or a building or a wall, and I'll put my hand on it, and I'll feel it. And I'll feel the texture, the peeled paint under my hand or the concrete. And that's when I become very self-aware, and I know that if I am dreaming, this is the most incredibly realistic dream I've ever had.
Steve,
all the time.
We've come to the end of the first hour, and okay. Free Dreamlanders, I would like to thank you for being with us as always. You should be staying with us for the final half hour when we are going to be exploring some other worlds with somebody who may actually have been there. And I'll tell also a couple of experiences that I've had that would suggest that this is something that happens to people. It's not a complete sort of woo-woo thing at all. And if you've had similar experiences, please let us know at Whitley@Streber.com. Maybe you'd like to come and talk about them yourself. Steve Neal's website is stevenealsart.blog.com. It's stevenealsart.blog.com. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much for being with us.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.